Hello, I'm Brandon House. Does your...
Hello, and welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. I'm Dan Eastman, your host, and today is Friday, March 24th, 2023, and we are continuing our journey through the wilderness of financial reporting to take a look at the news stories, financial news stories of the day, and try to not only interpret and translate them, but also make sense of them so that we, the people, can understand exactly what's happening in our economy and take our affirmative actions to take care of our best interests, how to protect ourselves financially from the winds and gales that howl forever in the financial markets. As you know, this is a commercial-free broadcast, and as such, we're funded by sponsors. And of course, I'd like to thank our sponsor, Swiss America. It's a very fine purveyor of precious metals and coins, and they can be contacted at 800-519-6271. Give them a call and ask for their free investor guide. And when you get it, read it and understand it. And if you have questions, give them a call. Certainly, precious metals investing is a place in your there's a place for that. And if it fits in your portfolio, you should take a look and give them a call. Very, very solid company with a very strong knowledge base, with a great track record, and certainly if you're interested in the precious metal sector or the collectible sector with numismatic coins, you can give Swiss America a call and you'll get some very solid advice. Okay, let's move to today's headlines. And today, of course, this is Friday, and we all know what happens on Fridays. Fridays are like bad news Fridays, where if you have bad news, you put that news out into the media on Friday, hoping it all blows over by Monday. Well, nobody's collapsing today, to my knowledge, but there's a very interesting meeting happening in Washington today. And of course, that is the Financial Stability Oversight Council, or FSOT. What's that? Well, let's dive into that. We see the headline, ooh, the big shots are meeting in Washington and they're going to discuss the bank situation and the markets and inflation. Well, who is the FSOT, Financial Stability Oversight Council? Well, let's dig into that, and we'll learn that in 2010, after the 2008 bank collapses and market turmoil of 2008, the federal government under the Dodd-Frank bill, which was the result of the blowout in 2008, Congress got together, and Congress, of course, introduced legislation and passed legislation that was intended to fix the problems, or at least provide solutions in 2008. So in 2010, Dodd-Frank is passed. And of course, Senator Dodd was from Connecticut and Congressman Barney Frank was from Massachusetts. And one of the cool things about these bills is if you're in Congress and you introduce them, then the bills are named after you. And then long after you left Congress, you know, we're still saying Dodd-Frank or Sarbanes-Oxley, and these names live on forever, which is good. You know, so they've got this financial regulatory bill, and within that bill was the creation of the Financial Stability Oversight Council, or FSOT. And they do closed meetings, okay? And which is kind of interesting in a democracy, you know, or at least a democratic republic, that we have closed meetings. So who gets to be in these meetings, and who are members of the FSOT? Well, there are 10 voting members and 5 non-voting members, and you kind of wonder what the 5 non-voting members are doing. Maybe they just come for the lunch. I don't know. But anyway, they have these 15 people, and they're all meeting in the on the FSOT meeting today. And these are the big shots. These are like the chair of the Federal Reserve, Mr. Powell, comptroller of the currency, which is kind of a classy old title. If you go back into American history, I mean, this is where I digress. The Congress and the federal government has the ability under our Constitution to mint coin. And that means, you know, nickels, dimes, quarters, silver dollars, you know, half dollars, whatever. And that was the power given to them in the Constitution as the Constitution was ratified from the after the Revolutionary War ended, you know, up through 1789, we get the Constitution of the United States. The idea was that there has to be a coin of the realm. Because if you go back to, you know, old Europe, every kingdom has a coin and a picture of the king on it, and or the queen. And that was the coin of the realm. And of course, that's what we the people, or they the people, used to trade. Okay, that was the coin of the realm. It was basically what people used as money to buy and sell goods. So when the United States was created back in 1789, when the Constitution was ratified and became official, and we were suddenly the United States of America instead of the 13 former colonies, we had a comptroller of the currency, which means the guy was supposed to, you know, figure out and administer the minting of coins to create money so that the new former colonists and the former colonies traded in British pounds. I mean, it was the money in use at the time of the Revolution. And when the Revolution happened and the Constitution, you know, that money was still in circulation. But then the U.S. started making its own money because, hey, we're a new country. We get to make our own money. So anyway, that's what this comptroller of the currency does. The U.S. still produces coins. I mean, we have pennies and nickels and dimes and quarters, and we have half dollars. And I think we have Susan B. Anthony dollars and a couple of other, you know, curios that are American dollar coins. And that's what the Federal Treasury does, okay? They don't print money. They don't print paper money. That belongs to the Federal Reserve. Because if you read your money, and I happen to have money right here in my desk drawer, you'll see on the very top of this money, it says Federal Reserve Note, okay? So these things are produced by the Federal Reserve, and coins are produced by the Treasury. And the problem is the Treasury doesn't have authority to produce paper money or digital money, and they do coins. So you have the control of the currency, and then you have the Financial Consumer Protection Head, which was an agency created basically to protect financial consumers from fraud. You have the Securities and Exchange Commission, which regulates the offer and sale of securities, and the securities are defined under the Howey test, of course, the specific definition of a security: stocks, bonds, investment contracts, other things. You have the FDIC chair. You have the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which is the group that regulates the trading of commodities in the United States, corn, wheat, pork bellies, you know, all the commodities that trade. So that person sits on this FSOT committee. The Federal Housing Authority, you know, you have to get the mortgage crowd in there. The credit unions and NCUA, which is the credit unions. And then there's always one position for the insurance industry, which is very interesting. There's a lot of money in insurance because insurance companies are very much like banks, where they have to hold reserves against loss. And the FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Company, is an insurance company, just like a life insurance company or a property and casualty insurance company. But the thing is, they take a lot of premiums in, and by law, they're supposed to hold a lot of reserves, which they invest in bonds that fluctuate according to the interest rate market. And then when there's a casualty or a death, they pay out. So those insurance companies have always been regulated. It's very interesting to know in the United States that of all the financial players, the only industry that is not federally regulated is the insurance industry, okay? The states issue insurance company charters. They set the reserve ratios, they approve who gets to be an insurance company, but it's very fascinating. The insurance company lobby has been successful in keeping the federal government from regulating insurance. So it's interesting that they bring somebody from the insurance industry. Is that life insurance? Is it casualty insurance? But that there's an insurance person there. So it's good to know that we've got a lot of people that are very important on this FSOT committee, and they're all meeting today. But I think the Fed chair and the comptroller and the FDIC and Federal Reserve, I think they've all been kind of like meeting for the last 3 weeks in a state of panic. But now we're getting a big group together and having another meeting. And of course, one of the things that the Federal Stability Oversight Council does is their job is to kind of take a look at the economy as a whole and watch for things that might be coming down the pipe. And they're very, very focused on climate change, okay, very important. I mean, you know, we got interest rates, you have bad loans, liar loans, we got to make sure with the, you know, climate change is going to destroy the financial market. So that's part of what they oversee. So I'm not quite sure what they're looking at today, but it's interesting that they're meeting. And of course, the Treasury Secretary, Yellen, is in the meeting as well, and she's had a rough week. I think America's had a rough week. If you go back 2 weeks ago when SVB, the Silicon Valley Bank collapsed, there was the issue that the depositors, anybody who had money over $250,000, would have lost their money, because that's the way it works for everybody in America. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation insures deposits up to $250,000. And if you have more money than that, then you lose it. That was the deal. And that made depositors careful. And then it forced depositors to do their homework, to keep an eye on their bank, to assess the risk for themselves. And if it was too risky, to move their deposits or some of their deposits elsewhere, spread them around, diversify. Well, of course, when SVB Bank collapsed, all the depositors were bailed out. And of course, it was a lot of celebrities, and I like to make fun of, you know, the famous celebrities who, unlike the rest of us, they got their money back when the bank failed. But that was the action of the Federal Treasury under Secretary Yellen. And of course, it created this phenomenal blowback by saying we have an FDIC that guarantees up to $250,000 or $250,000 per account. And you just went to infinity, so you just basically negated the existence of the FDIC. I said, well, we're not going to have any depositors take a hit because companies are in there, they can't make payroll, and, you know, Prince Harry's losing his money, we got to bail them all out, you know. So then the week later, she's coming around and she's saying, well, you know, maybe we're not going to do that. And then, of course, on Wednesday, when the Fed Open Market Committee was meeting to jack the rates another 0.25%, she comes out in the middle of that and says, you know, we're probably not going to defend all of these depositors. It's going to be a case-by-case basis, which means it becomes arbitrary and capricious. So if you're in the lucky depositor class and your bank fails and you know, Janet Yellen likes you, then you get your money back. If you're not, then of course you don't. So, and that creates instability in the market. And I have a sense that the FSOT is meeting today because there was so much confusion created by a former Fed chair making statements at the same time the current Fed chair is conducting the Open Market Committee meeting and contradicting, that it's just like, wow, that's a real sign that things aren't being managed correctly. So we wish these folks luck. I note that in the year 2017, Secretary Yellen made the statement that we will see no new financial crises in our lifetime. Well, that was 6 years ago. So we wish Secretary Yellen well. I hope, I don't know if her lifespan is any longer or shorter than the rest of us, but she's still alive and we're still looking at the next financial crisis. So hopefully they'll be able to get this crisis under control. It just goes to show you, when you make these profound statements, you know, sometimes they don't age well. And I think that's what's happened, that we have a financial system that is very much under stress for a whole lot of reasons. And when things get out of whack to the point where a bank fails, a bank or two or three fails, and you have to react as a government, it's best not to make definitive statements like no new financial crisis in our lifetime, because we're all still alive and here we are in the middle of the next one. So that's an interesting thing. We'll see what the FSOT has to say, if anything. It's a closed meeting, but we'll be watching with the, you know, the wisdom. I guess they like gathered the tribal elders. All of the tribal elders are now getting together going, oh, what do we do now? You know, well, hopefully they'll figure it out. Because in the end, the free market figures it out. I mean, that's ultimately what we're seeing. Free market concepts are ancient. They've been around since humans have been around, and it's been a long time. And effectively, what drives markets is demand and supply. And that isn't something that you can basically regulate. You know, the markets will clear. The markets will find their clearing point. You know, you have supply and demand. You know, the intersection is your price and your quantity. That's what's going to happen. And trying to, you know, it's like trying to hold back the waves of the ocean. You know, it's just, at the end of the day, the market will be where it is, because the same free markets that drove Marco Polo to go to China in the 1400s and the same free markets that dominated Europe in the 1500s, the 1600s, the exploration of the New World, which is, you know, the Western Hemisphere, it is all driven by the same market forces. And, you know, banks came and banks went, and, you know, there have been economic crises since the beginning of time. But at the end of the day, the markets dictate. So I guess from our perspective, as, you know, small investors in the middle of Wisconsin, we like to think about, you know, how do we position ourselves? And and ride this out and perhaps prosper. You know, hate to, you know, prosper on the backs of calamity, but, you know, they create the calamities. So let's, you know, that's why it's worth reading these headlines carefully. Anyway, we're also watching Deutsche Bank. That seems to be a bank that stocks have cratered. And it's another a big European bank, very aggressive. It's big, largest in Germany. It's a big bank, very aggressive in global capital markets. And, you know, I guess the interesting story about that is the stock is down because a lot of investors are saying it's too risky to hold over the weekend. Well, that's only like, you know, Saturday and Sunday when the markets are closed. And by Monday morning, if there's another bank problem or conflagration, you don't want to be the shareholder that bought at a dollar and have to sell it at 25 cents. So that's just something to watch because we had watched the Credit Suisse situation, which has stabilized itself. I mean, obviously, they now have one big bank instead of two big banks. But at the end of the day, the Swiss are very, very capable of running banks. They've been doing it a long time and managed to clean up their mess and, you know, wipe the soup off their tie. It's a little embarrassing, but at the end of the day, this is the nature of banking. And as I've been researching for this show, I do a lot of, you know, historic reading, and I've been looking at panics, financial panics throughout the United States history. And it's just fascinating how cyclical these are. It's the same story every single time. You know, the banks get out ahead of their headlights, and all of a sudden the music stops. You want to sit down, there's no chair, you know. So it just raises the interesting question, I think, which I raised yesterday, is, you know, of all the professions that are licensed in the world, everybody's licensed, everybody's regulated. You know, why aren't bankers should be regulated? They should have to have a banking license where you take a test and maybe work for another banker for a couple of years, figure out how to, you know, work the vault combination before they give you a green eye shade and put you out there. Anyway, that's enough of that. But I'm also looking at the consumer news. Of course, we're seeing today that consumer spending continues to soften. And that's not really unexpected. When you hear all of this financial news about banks teetering and the government running around trying to prop things up and the interest rates are going up, you know, consumers are wise. Ultimately, if you think about Adam Smith's concept of individuals and the invisible hand that makes individuals maximize their own benefit, not at the expense of others, but through cooperation with others so that both people are better off having done a bargain, then I'm better off, you're worse off. And that's the whole magic. So when consumers see this, they start to think, you know, first of all, consumer credit card debt has just exploded in the last couple of years. It's one of the things about the COVID and post-COVID period is that there's still a lot of instability and uncertainty in the consumer economy. And as a result, as people are, you know, not paid as much, losing their jobs, transitioning to work at home, shifting their income base, the fact is that everybody has a credit card. And if you can't afford gas because you don't have money in your wallet, you pull out the credit card and you put it on the credit card. Well, that credit card debt has creeping up. And all of a sudden, we're looking at almost $1 trillion in consumer credit card debt, which is a very, very big number. I think if you remember, I said, how long would it take me to hand you a dollar bill, you know, to get to $1 trillion? If I handed you a dollar bill every second, you know, 31,688 years to do it. The point is, $1 trillion is a lot of money. And this is people living, you know, trying to make ends meet using the one facility they have, consumer credit. And of course, as we look at bank credit at 4%, 5%, consumer credit is, you know, 18%, 19%, 30%, whatever the number is. So it gets to be very expensive. And then as the credit card debt gets bigger and a bigger part of your budget, then all of a sudden, all your minimum payment's bigger, then maybe I can't buy gas, or I can't buy as much food, or better back off on the vacations. And, you know, that's something that people have an innate sense that, you know, I better take care of myself here. And that's why I think we're seeing that consumer spending starting to soften. One really interesting indicator is that I saw a news story that Disney is laying off 7,000 workers. That's a big deal. I mean, think about Disney. It's a wonderful company, great American history to it, But at the end of the day, Disney's inexpensive. You want to go to Disney properties, you know, and enjoy a wonderful week at Disney. It's expensive. And, you know, if your credit card and, you know, monthly payments getting a little high and gas is still $3, $4, $5, you know, and eggs are $8, and you think, you know, maybe we're going to punt on that vacation this year because that's a, it's a lot of money. So as consumers are tightening up, then you see these big consumer driven companies starting to soften their positions. And, you know, unfortunately, 7,000 people are now, you know, unemployed, and that's not going to help consumer confidence because they're wandering around looking for jobs as well. And I would assume that Disney's employees are, you know, they're not minimum wage people. These are, you know, people with skills and talents. And when a company trims its sales, man, it's just a lot of displacement and it ripples through the economy. Of course, we heard Amazon was 9,000, you know, a couple of days ago, we were talking about Amazon shedding 9,000 jobs and 18,000 jobs in January. So, you know, you got 27,000 jobs missing from Amazon and, you know, 7,000 from Disney. And think about, you know, the local manufacturing concern in your town or, you know, auto dealer, restaurant, it starts to really put a pinch on the local economy. At the same time, you know, these people, they probably have car loans and have other debt that can't be serviced. And of course, if people are defaulting on credit cards and car loans, which is consumer debt, that's all held by banks. Another thing I noticed is that commercial real estate is really starting to struggle as well. And this is a direct result, I believe, of the COVID phenomenon, where suddenly, historically, Americans came to realize that a vast majority of them don't have to commute to an office, go into an office, do your job, commute home, you can work from home. And with the technology we have, I mean, think about it, before COVID, there wasn't Zoom, okay? I can't tell you the number of Zoom calls I'm on every day. It's got to be 5 or 6 Zoom calls. And I'm meeting with people from, you know, all over the place, and they're all on these Zoom calls, and everybody's got something important to say, and there's a reason for it. But what's happening is, it is a fundamental shift in how American white-collar workers are working. And of course, everybody right up until COVID, you're building these really fancy, tall office structures all over downtown. It's all, you know, reemerging and it's beautiful and these really amazing office suites. And you go in there and they're empty because people figured out I can sit at my desk and do Zoom calls all day, or I can sit at my desk and I can, you know, broadcast a financial report and I don't have to like drive. So what you're seeing is these commercial real estate properties, and most of them are owned by real estate investment trusts or REITs, but occupancy rates are not high, they're low. And people who have companies who have a lot of space and their workers, they're not coming back. You say, you know, you'll have to start coming into the office. I'm going to go look for another job. I'm not going to go drive downtown. It costs too much, takes too much time. But suddenly, there's a lot of vacancies in commercial space. Well, interesting thing about commercial space or real estate loans is that unlike home mortgages, commercial real estate loans tend to be on the books of commercial banks. Home mortgages are all bundled up together, and it's called securitizing. And you take the mortgage and you bundle up a couple of billion of them, and you sell them off to pension fund managers or 401k managers or other banks or whoever, you know. And then they buy this stuff. And of course, in 2008, those syndicates, those clusters of loans were stuffed with liar loans and non-performing loans. And you know, a guy makes $25,000 a year, and he's buying a $1 million house with a mortgage. Well, that's a different risk that hits the banks in their portfolio, their asset portfolio, the slice or tranche of their portfolio that is bond driven, with home mortgages that were getting a little rickety. But the really juicy loans for banks, and if you're a commercial banker, you want to take a mortgage on commercial space because you have a lien against real estate, which gives you a much higher collateral base. In case the loan defaults, you can theoretically sell it and get your money back. But also, they're shorter term. A mortgage is a 30-year, basically for a home, is a, you know, maybe a 30-year, sometimes you do a 15 or 20. But commercial loans for real estate are probably a 10-year with a balloon and adjustable interest. They're much more customized to the needs of the banks asset portfolio and they're short term. So if you own an office building and you got a 10-year note with a balloon and an adjustable rate mortgage, you know, interest rate, well, you know, the bell rings. As I noticed the numbers today that there's $270 billion into these commercial mortgages that are coming due in 2023, right now, this year. $270 billion. That's a lot of money. And if you look at coming due over the next 5 years, it's a stunning $1.4 trillion in commercial mortgages that are going to be coming due. And, you know, hopefully they roll them over at a higher interest rate, of course, because interest rates are up. But this puts tremendous stress on the banks, because all these commercial properties are like, if they're half empty and they don't cash flow, or the numbers aren't there and the rental revenue isn't there, it's not enough to support the existing mortgage. Let alone, how are you going to roll that over into another mortgage without rolling over like a zombie? You know, this is a very complicated situation. So when you look at these big banks, you think, man, what are they all coming apart? Well, you got consumer debt, that's one tranche if they are into consumer lending. Credit cards, you know, maybe getting a little soft on the payments. Auto, you know, we're hearing about, you know, repossessions coming up at net, you know, 10%. And suddenly you get commercial bank mortgage notes, which is really a big part of a lot of banks, are starting to soften. It puts banks in a big risk. So we'd much rather be, instead of talking negative all the time, we'd much rather be in a growing, healthy economy. And the question is, you know, how do you do that? How do you do that with a federal government that's $32 trillion in debt and broke and funding yet another war? You know, I gotta be blowing something up. Well, here we are. You know, meanwhile, our interest rates are going up because they perceive inflation, and gasoline's at $3 or $4 or $5 a gallon, wherever you live. It's, you know, we'd much rather see a much more tranquil economy. And I think that's what puts a lot of pressure, because the front bumper of all of this economic turmoil is the banking system. That's where it is. So anyway, that's a sad situation. The last thing I wanted to notice or mention is I noticed a story in the newspaper, you know, of that in France, the president of France, Macron, has amazing powers. He basically decided to change the retirement age from 62 to 65 years old. And in America, he's like, well, so what? We retired at 65, sort of, you know. Well, in France, they don't do that. And the idea is, of course, there's a national pension system, like we have our social security system, which we all paid into, and it's supposed to have grown into a big pot of money, and actuarially we'll pay all money forever. The French do it a little bit differently. His unilateral action of bypassing the Congress, which is very dictatorial, effectively has triggered massive rioting in the streets of Paris. I mean, you're looking at these videos and these photographs, the people are really, really angry, and it's set off what it's hard to believe that many people can be in the streets and starting fires or burning stuff down. You know, it sort of looks like the French Revolution in modern terms. And I thought, wow, that's another indication, because the people, we the people, are the ones that always seem to be getting, you know, taking the brunt. And the question is, in any pension or social security plan, you'd expect the best and brightest actuaries and, you know, financial people to calculate money in, money out based on the death rate. I mean, every insurance company figures out actuarial tables and projects death rate. Why can't these federal, you know, pensions do the same thing? That's a real question to ask. I watched that French situation, and everybody's saying Germany's going to be next. We'll see. I hope not. He never liked social unrest, but something to think about. Well, that's my report for today. I'd like to, again, thank Swiss America. Call them at 1-800-519-6271. Ask them for their free information and read it and see if that type of investment is good for you. And I look forward to talking to you next week. Hopefully, it'll be a quiet weekend. I think we'd all appreciate that. So have a great weekend, and thanks so much for tuning in. I really appreciate you listening. Take care. Bye.